and welcome back once again to Food Toxicology. And this is where the course, I guess, starts getting a little bit more interesting. It gets more interesting because we start to be able to perhaps visualize some of the endpoints of toxicosis. What I mean by that is it becomes a physical manifestation as opposed to interactions on the chemical slash biochemical level. This is something that we start getting in this lecture, target organ toxicology, and in the next lecture, teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis, we start looking at some of the endpoints that lead to the manifestation of gross disease. But today we're going to talk about target organ toxicology. Target organ toxicology, in fact, is something that we're going to use as one of the predecessors to an understanding of toxicosis, okay? We're going to try, in terms of learning objectives, to define target organ toxicity. We're going to try to explain the basis or specificity of organ toxicity, and then we're going to go through the mechanistic analysis of the various types of target organ toxicity. This will include, for instance, hemotoxicity or blood toxicosis, nephrotoxicity, hepatotoxicity, neurotoxicity, dermotoxicity, and pulmonotoxicity. And what these are going to do is give us at least a brief introduction to some of these endpoints. As you can imagine, in medical toxicology, each one of the toxic endpoints has a whole entire profession, so we can't begin to address all of the ramifications of understanding all of these organs and all the potential aspects of toxicosis relative to their functions. We will, however, try to provide an introductory understanding of some of these mechanisms of target organ toxicology. We're also going to describe some examples of target organ toxicity. We're going to try to identify some of the characteristic procedures that are used in terms of clinical medicine for determining toxicity in a target organ. How do we know that, for instance, renal function is impaired? We're going to do a little bit of an opportunistic analysis here in this lecture. It's, although it's not really a target organ toxicosis, and typically it has its endpoint in multi-organ or multi-system failure, we're going to try to explain the concept of oxidative stress, and we're going to try to understand the roles of the cascading effects of the enzymes, the antioxidant enzymes, and their response to redox cycling compounds. In food and in food toxicology, we always hear about the antioxidant properties of various chemicals, various additives, nutrients, vitamins, and food types. What we're going to try to do is understand the physiological basis of why, in fact, antioxidants in our diet are a good thing. Well, let's begin with some definitions of target organ toxicity, and we can talk about it as the collection of adverse effects or disease states manifested in specific organs in the body, okay? And sometimes we can relate the potential for an organ to have a specific toxicosis relative to its cardiac output. An organ that gets higher blood flow on a time basis will actually perhaps be exposed in terms of, for instance, first pass effects in the liver. Okay? Some of these organs actually have specialized tissues and specialized cells. Their properties are, in fact, appropriate for an interaction with the chemical compound. Sometimes these can be because it is principally just a chemically reactive substrate, or, for example, in the liver, when we go through biotransformation and enhance the toxicity of a chemical, that we, in fact, can have a cascade of effects because of the organ's process on that chemical. There are differentiated cellular processes and receptors, and so this differentiation actually will have customized relationships or chemical reactivity with certain specific chemicals, okay? Receptors, typically proteins, will have conformational and charge sort of dynamics in terms of the relationship of the receptor and, for instance, the hormone or the activating chemical. Sometimes these toxicants and metabolites can have specific reactive pathways. This might be because of its size, its electron distribution, certain types of functional groups, certain types of reactions with systems, for instance, immune-mediated reactions. Now, some toxicants do not affect all organs to the same extent, and this is perhaps understandable in that these organs have organelles and cellular structures and therefore chemical and biochemical relationships that are probably going to be different. For instance, lipophilicity of a particular organ, the fat content, the potential for that organ to biotransform it, the potential of that organ to store that particular toxicant will all have an effect. And so it may, in fact, have several sites of action and several different target organs, or it may actually zero in on one particular organ. Multitoxicant exposure, in fact, may target the same organ. Now, for example, if there is a biotransformation process occurring in the liver with one particular chemical and another toxicant is simultaneously exposed, we can have some additive or synergistic effects of the toxicosis resulting from the reaction of those two products or those two chemicals or their metabolic products. The target organ may or may not be the site for storage. For example, when we see hepatotoxicity from chlorinated hydrocarbons, those chlorinated hydrocarbons are typically going to be stored in lipid tissues. We also find that toxicokinetic processes, the ability of a toxin to chemically change over time, is going to help determine the concentration at target organs. Well, in terms of exposure of particular organs to a toxicant, one of the best indicators of perhaps susceptibility is looking at the relative cardiac output to the particular organs. And I talked briefly in other lectures about the difference, for instance, in blood flow dynamics during rest and in exercise. Things will change, but in this particular study, this is the resting cardiac output in percent for a 63-kilogram male, and this individual is at rest. And you can see that out of the 100% cardiac output, 27% is to the liver, 23.3% to the kidney, relative to 13.9% in the brain, and heart muscle down here at 4.7. And so single digits for many organs. The liver getting the most cardiac output should actually give you a little bit of an indication that, in fact, there's something that the liver needs to do with whatever the blood is carrying. Another way to look at this is the resting blood flow, the actual volume over unit time that's flowing to the organ. And our blood flow for this 63-kilogram male at rest is going to be 5.4 liters or 5,400 milliliters. Of that, the liver is, again, on a flow basis, getting the most flow, 1.5 liters per minute or 1,500 milliliters per minute. The kidney as well is processing a lot. And so you can tell that these two organs are actually doing a tremendous amount of interaction with all of the chemical substrates and the biochemical substrates that are available in the blood and the blood components. This is a little bit of an indication of the initial stages of potential processing of these chemicals and potential toxicants that are systematically distributed throughout the body following exposure. This cartoon gives you a very, very simplified look, and especially as we focus on the liver a little bit, of blood circulation. Obviously not a detailed diagram, but as we've kind of indicated before, in terms of the blood flow, the venous blood flow and the arterial blood flow, the point I want to make with this particular cartoon has a lot to do with the blood flow to the liver itself. You can see that it gets not only arterial flow, which makes up about 20% of the blood flow to the liver, but about 80% is actually through the portal vein. The portal vein actually coming from the vascularization associated with the gastrointestinal tract. So here we get the absorption of nutrients and therefore potential toxicants. The first pass effects here in terms of its processing in the liver prior to its ability to transform or metabolize or catabolize those substrates either as toxicants and detoxify it or as nutrients to metabolize or polymerize some of the biomolecules of life. This helps us kind of understand why, in fact, the liver gets 1.5 liters per minute of blood perfused to this organ. And so this filter, this bioactive filter, if you will, is exceptionally important in this whole first pass arrangement from taking all of the nutrients and therefore taking all of the potential foodborne toxicants and routing them into potential phase one and phase two biotransformation. Now we're going to start on our list of target organ toxicities, and the first one we're going to attempt to describe briefly here is hemotoxicity or blood toxicity. It's good to recall from any of your basic biology or physiology or anatomy courses what the basic blood cell components are. They include in broad categories erythrocytes, the red blood cells, leukocytes, the white blood cells, and the thrombocytes or the clotting factors associated with blood. Hemotoxicity is defined when either the number or the function of any type of blood cell is toxicant impaired. Okay? And so we've learned in this course so far about a couple of hemotoxicity advents and things like methemoglobinemia or cyanide toxicity or the oxygen exchange capacity of hemoglobin or other oxygen transport chemicals is actually impaired. So for example, some of the functional changes that might occur, things like nitrate-nitrite toxicosis leading to methemoglobinemia, cyanosis, carbon monoxide poisoning, sulfide poisoning, zinc toxicity, all of those potentially changing or interrupting, in this particular case, oxygen transport capability. The number of blood cells can actually be changed via a variety of disease manifestations. The number change in terms of red blood cells is referred to as anemia. Leukemia, when you have an increase typically in the leukocytes. Thrombocytopenia for the thrombocytes and agranulocytopenia for the agranulocytes. The way we do evaluation of hemotoxicity is quite simply doing a CBC or complete blood count. If you've ever had a blood test, you notice that if they've done a CBC, they've counted all of the major blood component cells and given you a response in terms of where you are in the range of norms. Okay? In terms of evaluating impaired oxygen transport, arterial blood gases can be drawn. You can put on oxygen saturation monitors that look at the color of the blood in terms of a fingertip dermal analysis. And we can also take a look at the toxicant or a metabolic product. For example, in the case of methemoglobinemia, where we've got an oxidation of ferrous iron on hemoglobin to ferric iron, which does not transport oxygen, the color of the blood and the capacity of the blood changes, and this can be analyzed in terms of direct concentrations via a clinical laboratory analysis. Now, I'm going to give you a quick case study here, and again, this is from Mortality and Morbidity Weekly, and this is in New York City in 2002, and this is methemoglobinemia following an unintentional ingestion of sodium nitrite. And so we've gone through the basic biochemical processes in terms of the oxidation of ferrous to ferric iron and hemoglobin in this particular toxicosis. This gives you an idea of what happens when things go wrong. And in terms of reviewing this, we've got some Middle Eastern individuals, five total, 40-somethings, an elderly individual at 60, and a younger one at 29. They ate a meal and reported dizziness, lightheadedness, and cyanosis almost immediately after sharing a meal. vomiting, and there was another individual in the household that actually did not eat the meal. The emergency technicians on arrival recognized that there was a big problem. There was unresponsiveness in at least one of the individuals. There was progressive respiratory distress and loss of consciousness in the individuals, and they were intubated. In other words, had a tube placed into the lungs to assist in breathing. The older woman began having seizures. In the follow-up of this case, at the emergency department, they were cyanotic and they had oxygen saturations that were, in some cases, quite low, 72%, as opposed to normal at 92%. The blood drawn for routine testing came out in a typical sort of black or darkish color, typical of methemoglobinemia. Empiric therapy, meaning the idea was in terms of consultation with poison control, this is classic signs and symptoms of nitrite toxicosis and methemoglobinemia. Treatment with methylene blue, and we show a little container of that particular dye, which is a reducing dye, was administered to these individuals. And the patient's blood came back from the laboratory with very high methemoglobin levels, and they were 21 to 87%, whereas the normal in terms of methemoglobin is about 1 to 3%. And so their oxygen carrying capacity was exceptionally low and probably untreated would have resulted in death. Within 10 to 15 minutes of administration of this particular chemical compound, methylene blue, the cyanosis resolved and oxygenation improved. As it turns out, a couple of the individual patients actually were hospitalized for several days afterwards. The follow-up disease epidemiological investigation in terms of the Poison Control Center suggested that an individual friend and acquaintance of these folks actually had put a sodium nitrite, which is a salt-looking crystal, if you would, into a bag that was marked iodized table salt. It was marked in English and in Arabic. This mislabeling, if you will, led to a series of incidents and finally use in a meal. The meal contained, again, toxic levels of sodium nitrite with the methemoglobinemia outcome. And so this is not how it's supposed to happen. Idea of a chemical, a potentially toxic chemical, being put into a food in high dose concentrations is cause for concern and warns us to kind of be very careful about what we use around the household and make sure that we don't mislabel things. Turning to our next target organ toxicity, it's hepatotoxicity. As I've kind of indicated in many comments here in the earlier stages of this course, the liver is a very functionally important organ for life processes in terms of its ability to biosynthesize many of the molecules of life and many of the polymers that are required for life. It's the most important organ in the whole detoxification and biotransformation pathway in terms of toxicology. Its high cardiac output and first pass effects make sure that, in fact, it does get a high dose and therefore a potential load of toxins and therefore the subsequent injury. As it turns out, the liver is a highly regenerable organ and so can stand a significant amount of abuse. However, we find that chronic abuse, such as chronic alcoholism, will lead to repair and the development of scar tissue, cirrhotic livers over time. And this cirrhosis or fibroid material will disrupt blood flow, disrupt capacity of the liver, and have a final manifestation in liver disease. We've also talked and several times about enterohepatic recirculation, and again, there's a cartoon on the website showing an animation of how we have a potential for re-exposure, because as the liver kicks out biotransform metabolites, typically large phase two metabolites through the bile, there is a potential for reabsorption, again through the portal vein and enterohepatic recirculation. This gives you an idea of what liver disease looks like. This particular liver, which is a bovine liver cross-section, this is a macro cross-section, and you can see by the tremendous discoloration that this is not a healthy organ. The lighter parts are the infarcted parts where the blood flow has been interrupted. You get some hemorrhage here in terms of tremendous amounts of blood collection, some necrotic tissue in terms of tissue where the cell walls are starting to dissolve, the cell structure is starting to disappear from the organ. This is an organ in failure, manifested from a particular disease syndrome, of which I'm not sure in this particular case. In terms of liver histology, as we take a look at how the liver operates on a microscopic basis, we've introduced, and the book introduces as well in terms of some cartoon diagrams, the functional subunit of the liver as the liver lobules. And these liver lobules are collections of hepatocytes, and they have a specific repeating structure, if you will, a redundancy. And so there is a tremendous amount of what you might call parallel processing in terms of the biotransformation of the chemical substrates in blood. And so this gives you an idea of the collection of hepatocytes within a lobule, the vascularization in terms of the hepatic artery and the portal vein, and as well the bile duct for the excretion, the synthesis of the bile compounds, and the excretion and collection finally in the gallbladder. In terms of the manifestation of hepatotoxicity, we can have cytotoxic endpoints where in fact the individuals or collections of cells are killed. This might happen as a result of lipid peroxidation, oxidative stress, and we'll talk about how that happens. Remember that the membranes on the exterior cells, exteriors of cells, are nothing more than a lipid bilayer. They're chemicals that can actually be acted on by other bioactive chemicals or chemically reactive chemicals. If you do have a strong oxidant, like a free radical, you have the potential for oxidizing this, disrupting the cell membrane, and therefore disrupting the entire cell structure. Necrosis or cell death or tissue death, cirrhosis, fibrosis, as I've said before, in terms of sustained or chronic injury and the formation of scarred tissue that will disrupt flow and function of the organ, as well as the potential development of fatty liver, the actual deposit of fatty materials in some of the sinuses of the liver material, such that it also then ends up following a blood flow pattern that is abnormal. We can have cholestatic hepatotoxicity where the flow of bile is interrupted. This can be, again, via physical barriers such as scarring, or the potential development of things like gallstones, actual deposits of mineral material that block the various outlets for bile as it's produced. We test, in terms of clinical medicine, liver function by looking at a series of blood indicators, typically liver enzymes. There are certain types of enzymes that show up in your blood in terms of normal levels, but by and large, liver enzymes ought to be in the liver. And therefore, high concentrations of liver enzymes found in the blood suggest that there is tissue damage on a cellular basis at a minimum in the liver, and that the liver is trying to respond and perhaps not. So liver failure is sometimes strongly indicated by the appearance of high levels of certain liver enzymes in the blood. There is well the potential for gross tissue effects. In clinical medicine, the way we do this on a living patient is perhaps one of the more invasive procedures short of surgery, and that's through a liver punch or liver biopsy, where a large gauge needle is actually inserted through the skin and into the liver. Again, the liver is a very regenerable organ, and a plug of tissue is taken and examined microscopically to examine for various sorts of physical or morphological disruptions in the liver tissue. Now, what we're going to do here is do a little bit of a sidebar. Again, not a formal area of target organ toxicology, but because oxidative stress is a broad-based manifestation of several modes of toxicosis and can result in tissue damage and target organ toxicology and systemic effects, I thought it'd be a good idea to put it in this particular lecture. Why are we susceptible to oxidative stress? Well, all aerobes, all air breathers, like ourselves, we generate free radicals in our normal respiratory function. So in a certain sense, we are combining with oxygen. And in this combining with oxygen, this oxidation process, we have essentially some enzymes that act as the firemen, if you will, at least if not put the fire out, keep it as a controlled burn. And that controlled burn is a part of our respiratory energy cycle. Our normal antioxidant enzyme system actually detoxifies the free radical byproduct superoxide from our normal respiration processes. What's kind of interesting about these is that these antioxidant enzymes are inducible. What you find, for instance, is that athletes will have a tremendous capacity to turn over oxygen or a VO2 max. They can breathe in and process a tremendous amount of oxygen. They don't burn up because, in fact, their inducible enzyme levels are typically quite a bit higher than yours or mine. Some of these enzymes include catalase, superoxide dismutase, sometimes known as SOD, and glutathione peroxidase, GSHPX, for glutathione peroxidase. In terms of lipid peroxidation, the beginning of the chain of reactions has to do with electron transport from redox cycling compounds. I like to think of redox cycling compounds as miniature batteries, kind of like the Energizer Bunny. They keep going and going. They can be charged and discharged chemically on a chemical basis. Some of these xenobiotics, they're readily oxidized and sequentially reduced by normal biochemical processes. These sometimes can lead to radical formation, and because it is a regenerable cycle, the battery is there, it's just that the electron redox state has changed on each cycle. Again, the toxic endpoints, we've talked about lipid peroxidation, but when you have free radicals are free electrons, they are electrophilic. DNA has a tremendously large number of polar functional groups, nitrogens and oxygens, and so the potential for DNA strand breaks is one of the toxic endpoints of oxidative stress. Typically, the redox cycling compounds are highly polar, and they have the ability to be oxidized by oxygen, and so that gives us a kind of chemical selection in terms of some of the oxidizing chemicals that will induce free radical formation. These compounds are also able to be reduced by the flavin enzyme FIAD. Give you an idea of some chemicals that are well-known classic examples of redox cycling compounds. The bipyridyl herbicide paraquat we introduced in our pesticides in food discussion. Paraquat is a classical test compound used for oxidative stress studies. Various nitroaromatics are in that category, as are some chelated metals such as zinc. And so there's many compounds that actually form this cluster of redox cycling compounds that have the attributes of able to be oxidized by oxygen and able to be reduced by FAD. In terms of some of the end products, these reactive oxygen species and reactive nitrogen species that are some of the end products of the free radical reactions generated by redox cycling compounds. And in the next few slides, I'll give you an actual metabolic pathway so you have an idea of the complexity of the oxidative stress and redox cycling process. But I'd like to introduce a few of the compounds. Superoxide, O2 minus, again, a respiratory product. Hydroxyl radicals, actually an environmental and photochemically produced radical. Peroxyl and alkoxyl radicals. And reactive nitrogen species, such as some of the oxides of nitrogen. Some of these are actually important in immunological function in terms of cell function and cell interactions. Now, these reactive radical species, excuse me, where do they come from? Well, obviously, from breathing oxygen in terms of our normal respiratory processes. They come from UV radiation. They come from infection. Some infectious processes produce free radicals. And as well, oxidants and redox cycling compounds that exist in our diet and in environmental exposure in terms of some pollutants. Now, the characteristics of these free radicals, they're highly reactive. No electron likes to be alone, if you remember from freshman chemistry. So they're looking for pairs. They can initiate chain reactions. They typically will seek out and find electron-rich molecules, in other words, electrophilic. They will damage cells and DNA. They are a factor in degenerative disease. When you talk about antioxidants and diet, you see perhaps linkages in the clinical data examining the aging process. In a certain sense, some folks think that a large part of the degeneration of the tissues that we find in elderly people is the response to this lifelong oxidation. We live and breathe in an oxidizing environment. Antioxidants, whether it be from normal diet or from biosynthesis enzyme-inducible enzyme processes, these chemical compounds are actually radical scavengers. So we find vitamin C and beta-carotene quenching reactive oxygen. We find vitamin E and beta-carotene breaking the chain reactions that radicals initiate. We find selenium glutathione peroxidase as quenching a peroxide-driven oxidation. Now, we have to recognize that not all oxidation is bad. There are a number of beneficial oxidative processes, one of these being chemotaxis of cells with immunological functions. Phagocytosis actually includes an oxidative process, as does clotting mechanisms and programmed cell death or apoptosis. Now, in terms of antioxidants, how do they work in terms of our dietary exposure or our physiological enzyme systems? They can, broadly, they can decrease the reactive oxygen species or reactive nitrogen species formation. They can bind redox cycling metal ions. They can scavenge these reactive species and their precursors. They can help with the adaptive antioxidant enzyme response. They can also repair some of the oxidative damage to biomolecules, as well as enhancing some of the repair enzymes. The citation I give for much of the antioxidant work is from a National Academy's Institute of Medicine analysis of antioxidants in food that occurred in the year 2000. This is easily found by Googling. It's a comprehensive tome, a few years out of date now, but in general gives an overview of some of the claims of antioxidants and specifically of nutraceuticals and food additives. To find out if, in fact, some of the claims, some of the data, what's the state of the art in 2000 in terms of food and antioxidants. It'll give you at least a good reading on what the range of data in the published literature is. By and large, the conclusions of this report is listen to your mom, eat your fruits and vegetables, because that's where the most important antioxidants come from. Supplementation may help, especially in degenerative disease or in situations where the diet is deficient in these particular nutrients. But by and large, eating a healthy diet is providing you with a tremendous load of the required antioxidants. Now, this next graphic is quite complex. It's going to probably require some self-study. On the website, I've put an enlargeable version so you can actually pick out all the pieces, but I did want to give you a holistic figure to allow you to kind of gauge some of the different aspects of the pathway of oxidative stress. I'm going to start here in the redox cycle, and here I've got this redox cycling compound. I've got a parent compound and a radical metabolite. Again, it gets recharged by the flavin enzyme and FAD on this side of the cycle. The radical metabolite itself is reactive. It can covalently bind to nucleic acids and bind to proteins and perhaps inactivate enzymes, all being toxic, potentially toxic endpoints. The pathway that we're most concerned about is actually the oxidation of oxygen to superoxide. That can be acted on directly via superoxide dismutase. Quite often it's a manganese or a zinc enzyme. To release it of its extra electron. It can also get acted on directly at that stage by catalase, which is typically an iron-bearing enzyme. Unfortunately, one of the end products of catalase interaction with superoxide can be hydroxyl radicals. That can have the endpoint of enzyme inactivation, lipid peroxidation, or DNA strand breaks. In terms of the cascading events in terms of enzymatic antioxidants, we have superoxide dismutase, which actually can create hydrogen peroxide as an end product as well. This hydrogen peroxide is still a very oxidizing and therefore very toxic chemical compound and needs to be acted on or reduced in terms of its potential impact on cell walls and tissues. And so we actually have the next stage in that, and that's the glutathione peroxidase stage, where we can take peroxide and convert it through water with the cofactor of glutathione. And so this allows us to actually recharge this particular system and take this particular oxidized substrate all the way to water, okay? So that gives you an idea of not only the endpoints, but the processes involved in the multiple processes involved in the oxidative stress cycle. Some of the endpoints of oxidative stress that we just covered in that graphic I want to point out are lipid peroxidation, DNA strand breaks, enzyme inactivation. We can have covalent binding to nucleic acids of some of the metabolic products, and as well these products or some of the free radicals can covalently bind to proteins, all of these being potentially toxic endpoints. Now, the enzymatic response that perhaps is most important in terms of this, and this is a subset of the graphic I put on before, we develop this reactive superoxide free radical. We've got manganese superoxide dismutase. We've got selenium glutathione peroxidase. We've got iron catalase. You can see the interrelationships of these antioxidant enzymes. And again, I want to express that these antioxidant enzymes are inducible. So their levels will adjust to the needs of the organism. Well, the next step in our examination of target organ toxicity is nephrotoxicity. Nephrotoxicity is toxicity, target organ toxicity, directed at the kidney. We'll have to understand the processes of the kidney from a physiological basis to understand what the disruption resulting from nephrotoxicity might have in terms of a toxic endpoint or a physiological consequence. Remember that the kidney has three major processes: glomerular filtration, tubular reabsorption, and tubular secretion. So as you go through the substructures of the kidney, you have not only physical, but you have membrane separation of substrates from the blood into the urine channel. Now, in terms of the toxic effects, the nephrotoxicity, if you will, we can have porosity or osmotic changes, porosity changes in, for instance, the physical structures of the glomerulus, osmotic changes in terms of how the membrane transports in tubular reabsorption, tubular secretion. We can have a modification of the reabsorption and therefore a change in water or electrolyte levels or nutrient loss. Typically, renal failure will mean that there will be a water imbalance, and typically this can be a life-threatening situation. We lose the potential active transport of minerals back and nutrients back into the blood after they had been transported into the nephron. In terms of kidney histology, this micrograph gives you an idea of what I'll call basic introductory histology of kidney tissue. You can see the roundish Bowman's capsule and the glomerulus in a repeating range here in terms of kidney tissue. And again, you can kind of see the lumen or the tubular aspects. And again, I go back in terms of histology. It gives us a two-dimensional representation of something that is, in fact, in three dimensions. So these thin sections, when they're cut, if you take a tube end-on, you're going to see a circular representation. But if you take a tube at its endpoint or a rounding, it's going to be an elongated structure. And so you can put your imagination to work to understand that these are, in fact, the proximal and distal tubules of the nephron going up and down in the tissue. This is a thin section. This gives you an idea, if nothing else, that these tubules are in fact tubes. This particular stain gives a nice representation of, in fact, that these are the piping, so to speak, of the nephrons. And that's going to be important in terms of some kidney dysfunction that we're going to discuss. Some of the syndromes associated with nephrotoxicity, they include nephrotic syndrome, and that's where we have a glomerular filtration injury. And so, for instance, in this particular, the actual size, the pores in the glomerulus actually are damaged. They allow larger molecules to get through, and so we start seeing protein in the urine or proteinuria. Lead toxicosis is one of the toxic agents that leads to nephrotoxicity manifested as nephrotic syndrome. In other words, these pores, they become gaping holes. These gaping holes are large enough to allow larger molecules, and so we get an exchange where we shouldn't in terms of large molecules, high molecular weight molecules at this size critical filtration zone. We have nephritic syndrome. And this also is a glomerular filtration injury. It has some of the characteristics of nephrotic filtration injury. Typically, it's associated with hematuria or hemoglobin in urine. Another nephrotoxic consequence is a condition called ATN, or acute tubular necrosis. This is where the tubes of the nephrons are actually damaged. The epithelial lining comes off, the skin cells are shed. Sometimes these dead cells will actually plug these tubes. It's kind of like a household plumbing problem. Depending upon the severity of the disease and the toxic insult and the injury, the tissue may or may not recover. In worst cases, it will not, and there will be chronic renal failure. There can be some impacts in the same sense with tubular reabsorption from chemical reactions on the tubular wall, disrupting or disturbing the membrane and therefore disrupting its capacity to regulate, for instance, osmotic pressure. A physical pathology can actually develop in here because of mineral imbalances. We can have obstructive uropathies or kidney stones, if you will. Essentially, again, more plumbing defects in the tubules of the nephron. Now this histograph here gives you an idea of what happens in toxic acute tubular necrosis. Again, you see the Bowman's capsule and the glomeruli. Down here, you can see what should be open tubes. The lumen is completely closed. It looks like impacted tissue, if you will, or plugged pipes, which is exactly what it is. There's epithelial necrosis and obliterated lumen, so there is no or limited fluid passage, so you have acute renal failure. And again, something that might be a response to a toxic episode. It might be recoverable. There might be sustained or chronic renal failure or renal dysfunction associated with this particular intoxication. Now, how do we, from a clinical medicine point of view, establish how the kidney is functioning? We use various tests in clinical science. One of these tests is the development of a glomerular filtration rate. This is done either by the administration of a compound that is actively filtered by the glomerulus, or more importantly, perhaps, is the analysis of creatinine in terms of what the creatinine levels are in the blood and the relative levels in the urine over a period of time to give you an idea of removal. These numbers can actually be used in various clinical medicine formulas to yield a GFR. We can also do active tubular secretion of a chemical compound, para-aminohippouric acid, PAH. This particular chemical is used to identify whether or not we are having active tubular secretion or not. This is an administered chemical. And then we can just look at the serum waste products. Do we have a large amount of blood urea nitrogen? Folks that are in kidney failure typically will have scaly white powder on their skins from nitrogen imbalance. It's an indicator of a protein catabolism and lack of removal of the catabolic byproducts of protein catabolism. And again, this is something that is a symptom of renal failure. All of these can be a function of a potential toxic insult to this important organ that is set up for elimination of toxicants. Another aspect of target organ toxicity is pulmonotoxicity, because the gas exchange function is critical to life. Toxicosis, damage of the lung tissues, can be extraordinarily life-threatening. This organ has extremely rapid exchange. It's high surface area, it's a mucous membrane. Chemicals that might react with water would have the ability to have a reaction on lung tissues because of the moisture content. In the case, for instance, of the Bhopal methacrylate byproduct or starting product, this particular chemical actually polymerized on contact with water. In Bhopal, some of the respiratory illness, and again, the numbers from that particular incident in Bhopal, India, amounted to, and this was in the mid-80s, about 10 to 20,000 people impacted, many thousands of deaths. The respiratory illness there was because this particular chemical starts polymerizing on contact with water. And so the amount of scarring and contact and plastics essentially forming in lung tissue led to pulmonotoxicity. This particular organ, because of its high surface area and its reactivity, it can be very responsive to chemical irritants in terms of just inflammation injury and impacting of the ability to exchange oxygen necessary for respiration. Obvious carcinogens in terms of smoking, allergens, mineral dusts, and various cytotoxic chemicals all can have potential toxic endpoints. Some of these endpoints will include inflammation, edema, necrosis of the tissue, fibrosis on repeated injury, fibrosis like emphysema, a lung disease, or in fact carcinoma. Some of the clinical manifestations of pulmonotoxicity can yield ARDS, or adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is a sufficient amount of damage to start causing cellular leakage of fluids back into the lung. Remember that the lung, the membranes, need to provide passage of air. If you start filling with fluids because of tissue damage, you start losing lung capacity. The outcome of ARDS is typically not good. Some of the endpoints also can include asthma, lung cancer, various infarcts or damaged tissue, damage from lack of blood flow or cell death, and emphysema. Another target organ toxicology, we talked about the skin. The integumentary system as being the largest organ in the body, and so there is a potential for direct dermotoxicity. Some of the manifestations of dermotoxicity include irritant contact dermatitis, allergic contact dermatitis, and we'll talk about allergens and their impact and how the cascade of effects has these clinical manifestations in a separate lecture in food toxicology called allergy. We can have phototoxicity, where because the membrane of the skin is also exposed to visible and ultraviolet rays from the sun, we can have a chemical reaction happening right there at the surface of the skin, again from the photoactivation of these chemicals. Some photoactivation of chemicals, for instance vitamin D, is required is a good thing. Quite often we find in dermotoxicity, when we have phototoxicity, that this is a bad thing. These particular chemical reactions yield some effects that are negative in terms of the potential toxicosis. We can also have cellular effects, integumentary cellular effects from various toxins. We saw early on in the course one of the manifestations of dioxin poisoning, which is also a generalized endpoint of halogenated hydrocarbon toxicosis. And this cellular rash is referred to as chloracne. The particular picture here is a phytophotodermatitis, and this is from an oil that is found in citrus that this particular person had a chemical sensitivity to. And we're going to spend quite a bit of time here talking about neurotoxicity because it's one of the endpoints, the target organ endpoints, that is perhaps of most interesting and the most concern to many people. In terms of neurotoxicity, we have to break down the nervous system. We have a central nervous system, or a CNS, and that's primarily our brain and spinal cord, and we have a peripheral nervous system, or the PNS, that is encompassed by our sensory motor control neurons. The neurons are made up of cell body, and we have dendrites and axons in terms of intercellular communication, in terms of neural communication. There are also many other cells in terms of the nervous system, the glial cells and some structural cells. We have talked about astrocytes as being part of the blood-brain barrier that will allow nutrient transport. There are various oligodendrites, Schwann cells, and myelin sheaths in terms of the structural part of neurons. There are microglia and immune function interactions as well with the nervous system. These cartoons give you an idea of the representations. These are pretty much high school biology representations at this point in time. But just as a refresher, of the interactions of these cells is typically by electrical transport. What we're most interested in terms of potential toxic interactions is toxins that impact the cellular structure in and of itself, but also ones that impact the chemical neurotransmitters that are responsible for neuron-to-neuron transmission. The micrograph there gives you an idea of a non-cartoon representation of what a neuron looks like. Now, in terms of understanding neurotoxicity, we have to understand some of the potential, some of the mechanisms of neurons, the chemical mechanisms, and therefore potential impact areas in terms of neurotoxic agents. Remember that in neurological function, we have active transport of sodium out of the cell and potassium into the cell, and this yields an electrical potential across the axonal membrane. We have a process called passive reverse transport that initiates a cascading depolarization, the buildup of the charge. At the synapse, we have neurotransmitters that are released, and they chemically transmit across the gap this depolarization to the next neuron. And so there is a potential for toxicosis in interrupting this chemical transport. These neurotransmitters cross the synaptic cleft to receptors. Now, in terms of where neurotoxins can have their impact, they can happen at the sodium-potassium channels. They can inhibit or stimulate, and we'll see this with several marine toxins like tetrodotoxin and red tide algae, dinoflagellates, that actually impact in further lectures here in the course. Neurotoxins can also bind neurotransmitter receptor sites. They can inhibit various areas responsible, various enzymes responsible for neurotransmitter catabolism. And so not only can it impact the receptors, it can impact the enzymes, but it also can impact the chemicals themselves. It can damage or physically impact the myelin sheath on the structural support for the neurons. It can cause more membrane damage and morphological change, and it can also stimulate just some occult damage, necrosis. This is a quick case study here in terms of a neurotoxin that is of interest to livestock owners. It's a chemical, a range of chemicals actually. They haven't identified specifics, they have some ideas. Yellow star thistle is a weed, an invasive weed that inhabits much of the western United States. Sometimes if you look out on a grassy field, you'll see some yellow flowers. These yellow flowers don't look particularly palatable because there's a lot of thorny substrates in there, but if the livestock are actually limited in terms of their feed options, they'll graze on this material. There's some indication, as in with loco weed and some other sorts of thing, that there's an addictive property to some of these weeds and some of the chemical substrates in there. Clinical manifestation is the animals start losing coherence, if you will. They start losing some aspects of brain function. On autopsy, a condition called nigropolidial encephalomalacia, essentially a necrosis of some of the tissue of the brain, is observed in response to consumption, a continuous consumption of yellow star thistle in livestock. One of the major areas of neurotoxicosis that we'll explore is called cholinesterase inhibition. Acetylcholine is a chemical mediator, and it's responsible for the physiological transmission of nerve impulses across the synapse. And I've drawn this cartoon here just to give you an idea of the compounds of the relationship of chemistry to physiology to who you are. Cholinesterase inhibition and the whole neurotoxicity field has had a tremendous amount of interest in the past 5 or so years because of the impact of terrorism and potential use of nerve agents. Historically, we've seen nerve agents used for chemical warfare, some of these nerve agents have had dramatic consequences in terms of highly toxic, highly violent death. In recent times, some incidences of nerve gas use in terrorism have made headlines. These have typically been small incidents, but because of the potential outcome, toxic outcome, it does terrorize many people. Now, in terms of the cholinesterase inhibition system, as we actually have a neurotransmission process across the synaptic cleft, We have an enzyme, acetylcholinesterase, that actually hydrolyzes the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. This particular enzyme is interesting because it has an active site that has two subsites, referred to as the esteratic and the anionic. And we'll talk here in a bit about the chemical relation of the neurotransmitter and also of neurotoxic agents for cholinesterase or acetylcholinesterase inhibition. So when we have a nerve impulse, it releases acetylcholine, which is rapidly destroyed by this particular enzyme. And what this does, it allows for a normal propagated impulse. It essentially turns on and turns off. If we didn't have acetylcholinesterase, we would have repeated receptor interaction, and so the cellular transmission would be always on. And so, for instance, instead of the light turning on and then turning off, it's flicking on and off. And so we get an uncontrolled neurological transmission. The interference of acetylcholinesterase activity can lead to accumulation of this neurohormone acetylcholine. This next slide is actually just gives you an idea of this, what we're talking about when we talk about acetylcholinesterase. It's a complex enzyme molecule. Within this fairly massive and complex enzyme, there are active sites, okay? And so when we do these representations of chemical structures of the active sites of this molecule, I want you to have at least a good understanding that there is a superstructure that presents these active sites in terms of the interaction of neurotransmitters. Now, this cartoon gives us the ability to kind of look at normal hydrolysis of acetylcholine by acetylcholinesterase. And so that big apparatus that I showed you in the previous slide, if this blue circle here is kind of everything else, the non-active site, this protein structural support for this particular enzyme. We talk about the serine site and the anionic site here as being the active ports of acetylcholinesterase. You can see that acetylcholine fits quite well into that docking area in terms of the relative positive charge on the nitrogen moiety and the relationship of this hydroxyl group in terms of binding at the serine group. In terms of the consequence of the hydrolysis, the end product is a choline group, and the serine group then also hydrolyzes as well, throwing off an acetyl. And so we end up with an end traditional sort of enzymatic non-consumption reaction. We have the enzyme that starts, it does its enzymatic chemical reaction, follows through, and then recharges back to what it was before we started the whole process. Now, when we poison this acetylcholinesterase, we create a moderately or totally irreversible chemical reaction, which then takes the enzyme out. It poisons it, it is no longer functional. One of the classic cholinesterase inhibiting classes of chemical compounds we learned about in our pesticide lecture is the organophosphates. And the organophosphates, and in this particular case, I've got parathione, again, one of the dirty dozen sort of more bioactive and therefore more toxic organophosphates, or OPs. For OPs, one of the chemical characteristics in terms of the structure is we have the phosphate group and we have the what's referred to as the leaving group. And what you find on organophosphate chemicals is that the leaving group is actually modifies the relative toxicity of the organophosphate chemical, but quite often in terms of the chemical structure itself, this is what is mostly different across a range of OP pesticides. And so if we put X as this leaving group, so we can kind of generalize this as OPs, or organophosphate chemicals, and by the way, sometimes you'll see an S here, a sulfur group instead of a carbonyl oxygen, but here's our leaving group. And so this is where the variance on a chemical by chemical basis for the range of OP insecticides might be. But you can see that this particular chemical reaction will have the ability to bind the serine residue on acetylcholinesterase. we have the leaving group leave, and the problem is the end product is a phosphorylation of acetylcholinesterase. Now, this toxic property is useful when you're trying to kill an insect, because it is neurotoxic in insects, but it is highly toxic in terms of its potential to injure higher animals. The problem here is that this is, by and large, somewhat irreversible. There are substrates, antidotes, if you will, that will come in and challenge this particular bond and try and cleave it off. One of the unfortunate situations about neurotoxicity from acetylcholinesterase inhibition is that poisoning, although the animal or the individual may survive, there are some neurotoxic agents that will have residual effects. The enzyme levels, enzyme production will always be somewhat inhibited. There is some potential for long-term neuropathy. Now, we have tried to stress on several occasions in this course that it's the interface of chemistry and biology, this thing we call toxicology. And so I always like to give a chemical representation of how these chemicals, these toxicants, are interacting with the biochemicals in the bridge to biology. Now, this is a very unique structural model. This is what's referred to as the gorge area of acetylcholinesterase. We talked about that in terms of the cartoon on the previous slides. This is a two-dimensional representation, again, of a three-dimensional protein structure. That oxyanion hole is down here in terms of what it looks like, and there is an OP binding to serine right here. And so these structures come in and play an important role in terms of the active site of this particular enzyme. If we blow that up a little bit so we look at the actual chemical residues, you can see that the in terms of the active zone of acetylcholinesterase, we've got the oxyanion hole. We have the serine residue that's able to actually bind with the acetylcholine. In this particular case, we have an organophosphate that's bound to this, and in fact, it now creates an intoxicated enzyme, inhibited enzyme, because this chemical here is now somewhat irreversible. It's a relatively strong bond. Now, one of the ways that we deal with OPs and cholinesterase inhibition is an antidote. One of the antidotes associated with trying to reverse this neurotoxic consequence is 2-PAM, which is pyridine aldoxime methachloride, also known as 2-PAM. 2-PAM is an antidote that needs to be given relatively rapidly because there can be some aging and some irreversibility. But again, 2-PAM, this aldoxime compound, competes with the organophosphate for that particular site. And its binding, although it competes pretty successfully, it is a reversible binding. And so it can end up in restoring enzyme activity. And so individuals that work around neurotoxic agents, whether it be chemical warfare or folks in the industry, 2-PAM is an antidote that typically is around in the same way medical offices near snake-infested countries will have antivenom around. This last few slides is going to be a description of a case study. This is anticholinergic poisoning from herbal tea, and this is New York City, 1994. What happens, for example, not that you impact the cholinesterase enzyme itself, but that you put in more neurotransmitter-type compounds that disrupt acetylcholine. This particular case has to do in 1994 in New York City when a couple were actually families were actually drinking a tea product that was purchased on local stores. It's a South American tea called yerba mate or Paraguayan tea. It's also sold in Brazil and Peru under Peruvian tea, the local names. This Paraguay tea is an herbal tea developed from the plant Ilex paraguayensis. and it is again native to South America. This particular group of individuals, in this particular patient, it was two people, a 39-year-old man, a 38-year-old wife, shared a pot of tea, and within 30 minutes, they had acute symptoms, including agitation and flushed skin. They were transported by ambulance. They had fever, dilated non-reactive pupils, dry skin, mucous membranes that were drying out, and bowel sounds that were absent. It was diagnosed as an anticholinergic poisoning. The treatment for this was two doses of physostigmine, which is a reversible cholinesterase inhibitor. So the idea was to inhibit cholinesterase reversibly, and the signs and symptoms completely resolved. It's interesting because this particular cholinesterase inhibitor actually comes from the calabar bean, also known as the West African doomsday plant. Its bioactivity was noticed by the peoples of West Africa. It was actually used in various applications, including in some cases torture of prisoners. The particular chemical, alkaloid chemical, from this was used as an antidote for an anticholinergic found in that tea. Upon follow-up of what was in the tea, they actually did identify belladonna alkaloids from the belladonna plant, also known as deadly nightshade. Atropine, scopolamine, and hyoscyamine were identified by GCMS as a part of the tea. In other words, in picking the tea leaves, somebody must have also picked some deadly nightshade, and the individuals were exposed to these potentially toxic levels of these particular alkaloids. So this is an interesting case because we've got one plant, the yerba mate tea, impacted by another plant, deadly nightshade and belladonna, and essentially the therapy or the antidote was a third plant substrate from the doomsday plant of West Africa. So this all gives you some idea of the relationships of disease manifestations and chemical intoxication in terms of target organ toxicology. Next time, what we're going to do is actually look at some other toxic endpoints that bear perhaps individual study that are courses apiece. We'll take a look at teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis, again, to try to give you an introductory analysis of these very important toxic endpoints. Until that time, we'll see you. Thank you.